Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of the fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station, leading to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems, only MagnaGrip eliminates 100% of all cancer-causing toxins within the station. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
In the world of firefighting and public safety, reliability is key. That's why for over two decades, first responders nationwide have trusted the Fire Store as their go-to source for essential equipment, apparel, and accessories. From top-of-the-line firefighting gear like helmets, boots, and thermal imaging cameras, the Fire Store has it all, tailored to the specific needs of our heroes on the front lines. But they don't stop there. Their extensive selection also includes EMS supplies, safety apparel like flame-resistant clothing and high-visibility gear, as well as a wide array of tools from hand tools to vehicle extrication tools, supporting public safety professionals in their duties. Partnered with industry leaders, the Fire Store's commitment to quality and excellence is unmatched, because when it comes to protecting communities, there's no room for compromise. Join the thousands of first responders who rely on the Fire Store. Visit thefirestore.com online or in-store today. The Fire Store, your reliable partner for fire and public safety equipment.
All righty, good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, depending on wherever or whenever you're listening. Once again, we'll start with gratitude and thank everybody for tuning in to the Perspectives on Leadership podcast brought to you by Fire Engineering. My name is Steve Shaw. I'm very proud to be an assistant chief of Fort Lauderdale Fire Rescue and a part of the Fire Engineering family as an author, a presenter at FDIC, and a host for this podcast. You have a choice of what podcasts to listen to these days. There's a ton out there, and I'm honored that you're choosing to listen to this one. Chief Halton years ago, and I mention this every podcast, but Chief Halton mentioned that whatever we do in terms of the podcast, in terms of reading, in terms of the article, we always have to be focused on the tactical way to deploy what we're talking about. So as in his honor, I will continue to focus on those tactics as well as the concepts during the podcast. As you guys know, perspective is my passion. It's my personal journey as a student of leadership to continue to be focused on that, and I'm always fascinated by how our perspectives continue to affect our ability to lead. The goal for the podcast, the same as it always has been, taking a concept or a trait or something along the lines of leadership and taking a deep dive down that rabbit hole. With so many amazing leaders inside and outside our fire service, I want to provide the opportunity and the platform to allow them to pick their brains and allow them to provide as many tactical, immediately deployable takeaways as possible. So thank you to David Rhodes, Diane Rothschild, the Clarion team, and especially my agency, Fort Lauderdale Fire Rescue, for allowing me to have this platform to give back to my brothers and sisters in the fire service. So before I introduce my guest, in several of the leadership workshops that I've had the pleasure of attending or the honor of presenting at, the subject of normalization of deviance has come up numerous times. And when it does come up, there's usually a unfamiliarity with the concept, to be quite honest. And it usually drives really good discussions in and then afterwards. So many times I leave these presentations or workshops thinking, man, there's more that needs to be said on this. So in my continuing research in the topic, I revisited a video of a keynote speech that was presented at an IAFF conference a long time ago, probably 15, 20 years ago at this point. The presenter was retired Air Force Colonel and former astronaut Mike Mullane. You know, they say when you never know what you get until you ask. So I asked. I emailed him and asked him if he considered on speaking on normalization of deviance on the podcast, and he said yes. So I took him up on that offer right away. So I am honored to be joined by retired Colonel and former astronaut Mike Mullane today. A brief intro, brief bio for Colonel Mullane. Colonel Mullane was born on September 10th, 1945 in Wichita Falls, Texas, but spent most of his time as youth in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he currently resides. Upon his graduation from West Point in 1967, he was commissioned in the U.S. Air Force. As a weapons systems operator aboard the Phantom aircraft, he completed 134 combat missions in Vietnam. He holds a master's degree in aeronautical engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology and is a graduate of the Air Force Flight Test Engineer School at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Mullane was selected as a mission specialist in 1978 for the first group of space shuttle astronauts. He completed three space missions aboard the shuttles Discovery and Atlantis before retiring from NASA and the Air Force in 1990. He's an author of several books, including the uniquely entertaining memoir, Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. So, Mr. Mullane, I am honored to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Steve, for the invitation. And talking about that video you saw that goes back 20 years, let me just date it this way. It goes so far back that I had hair. So that'll give you a reference point there on how long ago that video was. But I do appreciate the invitation and look forward to discussing the topic with you.
Well, this is an honor for me for multiple reasons. One, you're the first guest I've ever had that's outside a fire service, outside the fire service leadership group. And I, regardless of that, I know that you bring a lot to the table on a subject that we desperately need to talk about these days. And I'm really looking forward to diving into this. So that speech, that keynote at the IAFF conference was one for the books. I mean, I think that I was looking on how many thousands and thousands of views it had, and it's something we can keep referencing because the content is just so rich and just it's relevant as it was then, today, more than ever. But let me ask you this to start off with. Where did the passion for that topic come from?
Well, I was, as you saw, I was selected in the, as you mentioned, I was selected in the first group of space shuttle astronauts in 1976, 78. And I was with four of my astronaut classmates were killed on Challenger, including Judy Resnick, the second American woman in space, who I flew with on my rookie mission. Her and I flew our rookie mission together 17 months before Challenger. And then she was tragically lost on the Challenger disaster. So great friend. And the others were all close friends, too. And when you experience something like that, and I'm sure there are people out there in the firefighting world know what I'm talking about, that leaves a big, big impression on you. And you look back on the mistakes that were made, realize how preventable it was. And I started talking about it. Initially, I had no idea that I would end up kind of on a speaking circuit discussing the topic with high-risk operations out there, corporations and such. But it unfolded that way. And just sharing my thoughts on a very dangerous phenomenon, this normalization of deviance.
Well, I think you're right. We share a lot of similarities between military, between fire service, police service, first responders in general. We develop very, very tight, very, very passionate relationships over the course of a career and a lifetime. And when those relationships are stressed or tried, or we lose those friends along the way, it's powerful. I guess the silver lining in this is what you've done in terms of helping define normalization and deviance and really diving deep in there. I know if I'm one person that has read and followed that, I know there's a ton more out there. So you've definitely helped, especially in the fire service, a lot of people recognize what this means and why we should be paying attention to it. So,
oh, good. I would like to think someday somebody's going to stop and think, you know, I've heard a lot about this. It looks like where I am right now, I'm going to turn around and walk back from these risks that I'm facing and do it right.
Yes, sir.
That was certainly your objective, my objective in doing this. By the way, I should mention that, you know, I didn't invent that term, normalization of deviance. I was probably one of the early people that discussed it. But where I first saw that was in a book written by Diane Vaughan, and it's called The Challenger Launch Decision. And she's the one that talks about normalization of deviance and referencing the Challenger tragedy. That's the name of the book, by the way. The Challenger Launch Decision is Diane Vaughan's book. And she talks about normalization and deviance and their predictable surprises, terms that I use in my program. But I always want to make sure that credit is due to that concept. It may predate her, but that was the first time I saw it.
Right.
Was in her book.
And I think that what you did there is important, too. I think that we do a pretty good job of recognizing and giving credit where credit's due. As much as we try to, we sometimes fail to forget and fail to mention, but it's important. And I'm glad you mentioned that and gave the credit where it was due. So let's dive into this. Let's define normalization of deviance. Let's start there and kind of build.
Very simply, normalization of deviance is repeatedly taking shortcuts from safety best practices, any best practice, but since we're in life and death situation in the world of firefighting and some of these other high risk operations out there, let's say safety best practices, but it's repeatedly shortcutting safety best practices, getting away with it, until it becomes a new normal for the individual or for the team. Generally, in fact, I would say always, the reason people start shortcutting safety best practices is because they're under some type of pressure. And there's job pressures out there. Obviously, that's critical in the firefighting business. But other places, you have just an expectation you're going to get the job done in a certain time, and that puts you under pressure. But I think the greater dangers are self-imposed pressures, like wanting to get home to take the kids to the ball game. Yeah, the self-imposed pressures, I believe, are danger. As job pressures, people, I think, are very good at training, understanding, you know, leaders giving people time to get the job done, defining the red lines. Hey, you don't take this risk. And then we put ourselves under these self-imposed schedule pressures, or can do this, where we start taking shortcuts to get home early to take the kids to the ball game, or get a head start on holiday traffic or whatever it is. And it might be not wearing protective equipment, thinking, I've gotten away with it so many times. I've done the job with protective equipment so many times in the past and never needed it. I can certainly do the job now one time without wearing the protective equipment. And that's going to save me time to be able to get this, accommodate this pressure I put myself under, getting home to take the kids to the ball game. So you take that shortcut, and typically you get away with it. And as soon as you do that, your brain gives you this false feedback that a risk that you previously have been trained to understand is absolute. You never step over this red line. You always wear protective equipment. Well, now you didn't wear protective equipment. Nothing bad happened. And so you start thinking you can manage this risk. It's not absolute. I can manage it. And so that's there in your brain. And so if next time you're under these same pressure circumstances, you're going to be mildly tempted to step over that red line again. And it might metastasize into taking other risks in other areas because you found that you can get away with it. And you keep doing it, you keep doing it. And after a while, you no longer see it as a shortcut. It's ops normal for you. You've gotten away with it so many times, and you're losing sight of the risk that you are now facing because you have stepped over that red line. And what Diane Vaughn uses the term in her book, that normalization of deviance leads to predictable surprises. And then you find yourself in a predictable surprise. And in the world of hazardous operations, where life and limb are on the line, that predictable surprise can be very, very ugly in the form of a serious injury, death. It's something that in your world of firefighting and the world of a lot of people that operate in high-risk operations, those predictable surprises can be very, very ugly.
You know, you said a lot there. And first of all, thank you for that really, really good definition and detailed description of what this is. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking of those things where in our world where sometimes the comments made after a fire, well, the fire went out and nobody got hurt. And during that process, yes, the fire went out. Of course, the fire is going to go out. The fire will go out eventually. And most of the time, the vast majority of times, nobody gets hurt. It doesn't mean that during point A to point B, where the fire started and the fire went out, that in between there, things weren't followed exactly like they should, or we weren't, as you just said, maybe crossing those lines that we know we shouldn't cross. So sometimes I don't like when I hear that out there, well, the fire went out. Yeah, but did we do everything the way we're supposed to do? And it speaks to that in volumes more.
I was going to say, one of the things that you can see this in the Challenger disaster, which was a predictable surprise precipitated by a 4-year normalization and deviance process. But what happens is people, you begin to hear this term experience base, you know, that, our experience, you're doing it in your mind. My experience in the past has been I get away with it. So what that means is you're starting, you originally had a risk red line established in your training. You don't do this, okay? But now that you've gotten away with it, you begin to base all future risk taking based on the experience base of having gotten away with the risk in the past. And when you get there, that is normalization of deviance. There's no ceiling to that. When you start basing all your future risk justification on your success with past risk justification, there's no ceiling. And you're going to expand the risk taking, expand it, and eventually find these ugly, predictable surprises.
Yeah. So as we're talking about this, and as I reflect, you know, as you alluded to, that, you know, whether it's military or police or fire, you know, the results of which we're talking about could lead to lethal consequences. I think that's a term you use, lethal consequences. And as I'm thinking about examples from the fire service, I can think of just a host of things. And as I was preparing for this, I'm thinking of, okay, what in my mind have been things that could cross that line? Everything from not wearing seatbelts to not wearing our bunker gear when we're supposed to, whether it's on a nuisance alarm or a fire alarm that we've been to multiple times, not backing the apparatus up with a backer, not checking our gear in the morning, not wearing our SCBA waist straps. A lot of times you'll see on videos of fire scenes, people wearing their SCBAs, but the waist straps are just flopping in the breeze. And not wearing chin straps on a tactical way. If we have, for example, the fire service, if our hose loads for a high-rise fire are supposed to be 2.5-inch hose loads, and we're going up there thinking, well, it's a small fire, it's a pot in the stove, I'll just bring up the 1.75-inch bundles, the garden attack lines, and we'll go that way, you know, and you get away with it. Just as you said, we got away with it. Why can't I do it again? So there's so many fire service examples that we can go on from. And even on the admin side, am I not signing the proper confidentiality forms for promotional tests? Am I not filling out all the paperwork for a properly done live fire exercise at either an acquired structure or my training center? Am I doing my job, making sure that every time I do the same thing? So I guess from your perspective, what are some other ones in our world that come to your mind, whether it's military, NASA, Air Force? What other examples could be out there, do you think?
Well, you're talking about procedural compliance. That's where your risk red lines are incorporated into your procedures. And so if you're following your procedures to the letter, you're going to be operating on the right side of those risk red lines. And for repetitive tasks, and you were indicating that, I think, in your discussion, there's lots of jobs out there in hazardous operations that are repetitive. And when they're repetitive, people can go into this autopilot mode and think that they know these procedures. They don't need to refer to them. I've done this so many times in the past that I just don't need to pick up that checklist and go through it item by item. We have that in the world of aviation. I remember, for example, one of the squadrons I was in, a pilot took off on a Friday and landed at a remote base for some training over the weekend. He came back Monday, got in a plane to fly back home. Immediately after takeoff, he had to declare an emergency for low fuel. He took off without gas in the jet. And it was good weather, daylight, so he was able to just circle the pattern, come in for an emergency landing, and it was all okay. He got away with it. But if you look back on the checklist, which I have, on step 10 of the pre-flight checklist, it says to check that you have fuel in the plane. And obviously, this was a repetitive task for him. He had flown for probably 10, 15 years, thousands of hours in the plane. And he, over these repetitive tasks, kept putting the checklist aside, thinking, oh, I got it in my brain. I know how to do it. And obviously, in that particular example, he had something on his mind that was distracting him, and he did not check the fuel and ended up only getting embarrassed. But had it been bad weather and a night takeoff with low fuel, he well could have lost the aircraft and maybe lost his life. So we have to be on guard when you start doing these repetitive tasks. Always refer back to the procedures. Just nothing yesterday is making you bulletproof. Your experience of not picking up the checklist yesterday doesn't mean you're bulletproof. So always follow your procedures. Every single day, just think of it as a new job. It's the first time you've ever done it. And follow it, because they keep you on the right side of the risk red line.
Mm-hmm. No, they're there for a reason. And a lot of times complacency sits in, and it's easier, like you said, just to, it didn't happen yesterday. Maybe I don't need to check out the truck like I did. There's so many examples of what that could be in our service as well.
Well, there was another example too. And well, there's all sorts of examples of this in aviation. No question about it. You go back and look, you'll find these, you know, people taking off without taking covers off of the PDOT tube, which gives you airspeed when you're airborne, not checking for lock controls. They had a business jet in 2014 that crashed up in Massachusetts and killed, I think, 7 people on takeoff. And they went back and found these pilots had flown together many, many, many times. It was a repetitive task for them. They found in reviewing, I guess, cockpit voice recorders and such, they rarely did any type of pre-flight check. And on this particular day, they took off with the controls of the jet locked. And when the pilot went to pull back to get airborne at high speed, he couldn't. The controls were locked, went off the end of the runway, and everybody was killed. So these, we're human, and when we get into these repetitive tasks, we can fall into this autopilot and autopilot mode. And the reason we have procedures, and this is important to understand, when you operate in hazardous environments, those procedures are figuratively written in blood. That's the first thing my aviation instructor said to us in the class on training for the jet we were going to fly. He held up a checklist and said, these procedures are figuratively written in blood. There's a history of tragedy incorporated in these procedures. He said, if you go back in history, you'll find instances where planes crashed, crews died, lessons were learned, and these lessons have now been incorporated into your procedures. So follow your procedures. I don't know, when you were talking about all those procedures for firefighting, I have no idea, you were talking Greek to me, right? But it doesn't matter, because the fact is, in firefighting, as it is in aviation, your life is on the line, and everybody you're working with, their lives are on the line. In these situations, I can guarantee that your procedures in fighting fires are figuratively written in blood. There's a history of tragedy incorporated in firefighting. Lessons were learned. Those lessons have now been incorporated into your procedures. That's why you follow procedures, to stay on the safe side of those risk red lines.
And I think one of the most profound things you said there is not only our lives are on the line, but their lives are on the line. It's not just about
exactly
but the individual. It's about the team. It's about the group. It's about more than just you. That's a statement.
That is definitely something. When you step out in any hazardous operation, whether you're climbing in the cockpit of a shuttle, climbing into an airplane, going out and jumping on that fire truck to fight fire, when you do that, you are now instantly connected to everybody around you. Their health and safety depends on you. And same with them, you know, you're safe and healthy depends on their actions. So you're a team out there, but it's actually more than a team, because you're connected to their families. You may not have ever met their families, but you are connected to their families. And your actions can have irrevocable consequence to an individual and therefore to their families. You've never met those families, but you're connected to them. And you ought to think about that when you're going out there, that everybody, it's more than a team. You're a family out there, an extended family that includes everybody else's family.
Families
watch out for each other.
You hit a nerve there, because obviously in the fire service, that's our second family. That's a huge thing for us. We take that very seriously. And you hit a nerve there, because a lot of times when I'm doing a presentation on leadership or something, I'll ask the question about safety. And I'll ask the question, okay, we keep our people safe. The question is, who do we keep our people safe from? And I swear to you, the first response I get out of every time I've asked that question is, almost jokingly, ourselves. We keep them safe from themselves. We keep them safe from themselves. And I think about that, because a lot of times we have to enforce the rules for people that just maybe having a bad day, maybe just didn't want to put their seatbelt on or whatever. And speaking of seatbelts, I always tell the story. I used to work with a guy years ago who, when I was a new officer, he was a 30-year driver. And I remember being in the truck with him, and I'm like, hey, man, you need to wear your seatbelt. And he gave me a rash of crap and almost made fun of me for making him wear your seatbelt. And I remember on the way back from the call, I'm like, listen, I need you to wear that seatbelt. And it's a longer story, but the crux of it is, after yelling back and forth and getting back to the station, him, the whole crew, just him hawing and yelling and screaming, and him explaining to me that I'm a senior driver, I don't need to wear my seatbelt, me going, oh my God, what is wrong with you? At the end of the day, though, the conversation we had when he realized he had made a mistake was, I said to him, I understand that not only do you have to do this, but I know your family, I know your wife, I know your daughter. And I can't be in a position that if something happens and we get into an accident or a collision or something and you fly out that window, I don't know how to respond to your family if that happens.
Yeah. You don't want to be standing there saying, I saw you not wearing, you know, standing at a graveside ceremony and knowing in the back of your head, he wasn't wearing a seatbelt.
Yep.
Now, you spoke up on it, obviously, but a lot of other people might just say, oh, well, that's his business. And now you're standing there and comforting a widow and wishing you could go back to that moment. And by the way, that's another term I use when I'm giving my program, is accountability. In hazardous operations, you don't want to be facing an accountability nightmare. By that, I mean, you don't want to be visiting a friend in the hospital and thinking to yourself, I saw that hazard every day. I saw him doing that every day and I didn't say anything. I didn't challenge him on it. And now he's seriously injured, or God forbid, you're at a memorial service and thinking the same thing. You will want to go back to that moment and have said something, insisted on on making sure that people in the in your work environment were safe. In that case, wearing a seatbelt, you don't get those opportunities. As I said, when we're every day, when we're on the job, our attitudes, our behavior, what we think, what we don't think when it comes to safety, what we're saying around the coffee pot, all of our attitudes about safety, it's like being, the team is like imagine a placid pond, and everybody's standing at the rim of that placid pond, and our actions are sending out ripples, invisible ripples that are influencing other for good or bad, and they're doing the same to us. And at the end of the day, it's this interaction of ripples that make a team culture. Mm. And at the end of the day, you want to be proud of the ripples you set out and say, I did it right. I made this team safer. I made it better because of what I said and what I did and the actions I took. Because the alternative is what we were just talking about, and that is an accountability nightmare where you're wishing you could bring back those ripples. If you could do it over, if only I could do it over. Looking back, for example, on the Challenger tragedy, I don't think people can think about it as how many people seeing that disaster, knowing that 7 astronauts died, 7 families irrevocably injured, and be wishing, I wish I could go back to that meeting and it said something. I wish I could do it. And that's the reality of hazardous environments. We can't bring back our ripples. They're out there forever. So that's why we want to make sure that at the end of the day, we're proud of our ripples, that we are accountable. We're going to say, I own these because I made this team better and safer. And that's a good analogy, I think, out there. You don't get your ripples back. And there's been a lot of people and a lot of tragedies that are sitting there watching it unfold and wishing they could go back. And you don't get that opportunity in hazardous work.
I am so glad that we're on this path. That was profound, and I'm glad you dove deep there, because I know that everybody listening to this, that resonates with them. And your analogy of the coffee pot, for us, it's the firehouse kitchen table. That's where the magic happens. That's where we come together. We talk, we interact, we live our lives around that kitchen table. And then the same thing with the ripples. It's a very similar analogy. So I'm so glad you went there. So the former editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine, Bobby Halton, always used to tell me we have to be focused on the tactical ways to deploy what we're talking about. So in terms of the normalization and deviance, in terms of talking about this, how do we combat that? What are some tactical ways that we all, as leaders, whether it's in our personal lives or in the fire service or wherever, can tackle and avoid these potential catastrophes?
Well, I think obviously procedural compliance is a biggie. Again, with repetitive tasks, it's hard to get that in people's heads. But as leaders, we need to make sure that people are procedurally compliant. And again, showing people the consequences of not being procedurally compliant and making them realize that risk has no memory, that when we take a risk, it's not somehow magically diminished the next time you do it. I think we as humans have a very difficult time getting that through our heads. We tend to believe a risk taken is a risk diminished. You know, you use a ladder precariously at home, and the first time you do it, you think, wow, this is dangerous. I could die. I could end up in a wheelchair. I got to be careful. But you get away with it. The next time, you don't have that same heightened sense of risk. And then eventually, you don't have a sense of risk at all. You've done it so many times, you don't have that sense of risk. You've normalized that risk out of your brain. But risk has no memory. The laws of physics that dictate the risks that you face every day with working at heights and fire and poisonous gases and explosions and all this, all the physics associated with that, the laws of physics have no memory. They don't know that yesterday you didn't wear the right protective equipment. And so therefore, they're going to modify those risks. No, it doesn't work that way. Risks are absolute. They're based on the laws of physics and they don't have any memory. So those are types of things that need to be, I don't know. You're asking basically how do you get in somebody's head and rewire it? Like that firefighter you were talking about, not wearing a seatbelt. You know, we can't do that. We can only show the examples, I believe, show the criticality of doing these things, not letting these pressures drive us into these shortcuts, understanding the consequences of it, not just to you, but to the other people around you and their families. Though all these things we're talking about, you know, hopefully will be taken to heart by people. But again, I don't have any magic bullet. I don't have a vaccine that you can give to people and they're not going to take shortcuts or not follow procedures. It's just the message over and over. They got to hear it consistently from leaders and hold people accountable too. You know, if people are doing something that is jeopardizing their health or the health of others around them, you know, they need to know it.
I think you did, and I appreciate the response, because I think what I'm hearing from you is just explaining the why we're doing things is huge, because a lot of people forget why we do certain things. So it's not wrong to reinforce to them why we're doing this. Like you said, these things are anecdotally or figuratively written in blood. But the new generations, and I can think about even in my department, there's things that we've incorporated in the last few years because of tragic things that happened, whether it was a line of duty death or a major catastrophic injury or whatever. Now we have a procedure for it. I know that in 20 years from now, it's just going to be an SOP to somebody. It's not going to be something that they're tied to because they knew that person that fell off a ladder or didn't wear their seatbelt or whatever it is. So the why is important, and you alluded to that. But the other thing you said is just having going to the person, holding them accountable, have the conversation, not just look at it and ignore it, but step up, do your job, be the leader, be the one with the backbone, be the one to say, hey, I need you to do this, whether it's a simple reminder or whatever it looks like, but just having the conversation is massively, massively important. So,
Well, I was going to say too, in a leadership role, you lead by example too. I would definitely be telling the people, hey, if you see me do anything that's putting me in danger, I want to know about it. I'm not going to get my back up. I want to know about it. At the end of the day, I want everybody going home safe. I want to go home safe. We all want to go to our families. So take my back. I'll take yours. Let's be a team out there. Let's be a family and watch out for each other. Don't anybody get their back up when something is pointed out, like putting your seatbelt on to be safe. Hey, I'm trying to help you. As you pointed out, I don't want to be talking to your widow because you flew through that window. Come on, let's all, that's what teams are. It's a family. People need to understand that. I know, you know, some people feel like it's somehow an attack on their manhood if they're called down about something. And you got to get out of that mode, folks. Be a professional. Recognize that people are trying to help you when they say things to you like, hey, wear a seatbelt or wear that protective equipment, or let's go back over this firefight we just did and pick it apart and see if there were other places where just by sheer luck somebody didn't get hurt, and make sure we're covering that on the next firefight. But it's really important that people understand what we're talking here. Ultimately, it's families. You know, at NASA, when the families go up to, a long story here, but I'll try to shorten it. The families of astronauts did watch the shuttle launches from the roof of the Launch Control Center. They were up there, basically guarded with another astronaut at their side, the families were, to prevent the press from getting from them. They're up there, they're isolated, the press can't get to them in the event of a disaster. And as you might imagine, it's high stress times. But in the hours that they're in the Launch Control Center offices waiting to go on the roof to watch the launch, many of the astronauts had kids, and they had a whiteboard there, and they allowed these kids to draw on the, you know, just silly things and do things on these whiteboards. And then somebody, I don't know who started this, was a good idea. After these missions, they would take that whiteboard and frame it and put it on the walls of the Launch Control Center, basically to remind people who are going to work, this is at what stake. This is what's at stake. In these firehouses, I would encourage everybody to bring pictures of their families and put them up on the walls. And everybody said, and I imagine they have open houses and things like that, and everybody bring their families out. And people meet them face to face, and then ask yourself, do you want any of these families to someday be shedding tears? And you standing there knowing that, oh, I saw that. I could have taken action to fix it. I didn't want to challenge this guy about it. You know, just think about these things. It goes back to family.
No, and you said that, and obviously our firehouses being what they are, we do have that. We have pictures everywhere, and it's a constant reminder coming in every day that you're not only trying to keep yourself safe, but you're keeping them safe, and you're thinking about their family. So it's there's a lot of similarities between that world and ours. And it's wonderful to hear those commonalities because they ring true to us in multiple ways. So in terms of whenever I have these conversations with people, I always ask in terms of leadership, I always ask, you know, what in terms of traits of leadership or character traits on leadership do you think are most important? So from your perspective, if you had to pick one or a couple that are just the top from leadership traits, where does your mind go?
Well, one thing I think is going to be at the top of any leading in hazardous environments is in hazardous work is to create an environment that what I've heard referred to, and I've co-opted, courageous conversations. Mm-hmm. In other words, stand there as a leader and say, I can't lead this team and be in the safest it can be unless I'm seen through everyone's eyes. I do not want anybody being intimidated by my position, by my longevity. I don't care if you're brand new here to the job. We're not clones. We all are different. We all see problems and hazards and better ways to do things, safer ways. And I want to capitalize on that vision that you have, that unique vision you have. So build this environment where, hey, I want to hear from you. Don't be afraid to come into my office. Tell me something that's bothering you that you've seen that needs to be fixed, or you don't know how to fix it or how to address it. But you just don't want anybody out there afraid to come in and talk to you as a leader operating in hazardous environments. I'll give you an example of a courageous conversation moment I had in my life. When I was in Vietnam in 1969, I was 23 years old, flying in the back seat of the reconnaissance version of the Phantom. We would go out and fly alone, unarmed, very high speed, low level, over enemy targets, photographing for the intelligence people. And as a junior officer, I was a first lieutenant and flying with other junior officers. We were flying pretty regularly, maybe anywhere from 4 to 6 times a week, maybe on a combat mission. And so a lot of experience resident in us, junior officers. Well, I was on this particular story, a brigadier general from headquarters was flying in my front seat. And before, as I was getting into the plane, he stopped me and said, Mike, you see these stars on my shoulder? You're a first lieutenant, folks. That's all you can see. Any rate, I said, yes, sir. And he says, well, let me tell you something. These are not going to keep us safe up there. If I make a mistake, you're going to die a millisecond after me. Basically, what he was doing was creating this environment where he did not want me being intimidated and silenced by those stars, knowing that I had a wealth of combat experience that he did not have. He might have been flying once or twice a month. And he wanted me empowered in that backseat, talking to him. And that's a good example of a great leadership moment is when somebody says, hey, I want to see through your eyes. And so don't tell me. Don't assume somebody else is going to bring it to me. Don't assume I'm aware of it. You bring it to me. See something, say something, do something. And that do something means bring it to me.
That's, and again, like you said, there's so many similarities there in terms of what you're talking about and the opportunities that present themselves every single day in the fire service. And to your point, when the first day on the job, when I was at Fort Lauderdale, this is September of 1999. I remember the first day I was on engine 35, and my lieutenant at the time brought me in, sat me down, kind of covered some things, but also asked me, what do you do? What do you bring to the table? I want to, and kind of the same conversation. He didn't assume that I was just this dumb kid who didn't know anything. He wanted to know what my life experiences were, what I brought to the table. Maybe I am in a position based on my experiences, job history, whatever, would be able to see something that he wouldn't on a scene, on an incident. And he wanted to make sure it was clear to me, hey, open your mouth if you need to. So I'm so glad you brought that up because those are conversations. Yeah. And as you said, those courageous conversations and encouraging those conversations are something we need to do so much these days, especially when everybody's doing this on their phones so much. I mean, yeah. Listen, I'm a fan too. I'm a fan of my phone too, but we need to be at the firehouse kitchen table much more, having those conversations, diving deep into each other, just like you mentioned. So that's
well, when you yeah, you were talking there about being a new guy on the job, and all you older folks out there need to understand what is the priceless gift that the new guy on the job brings that nobody else that's been there for years has. And that is, they don't bring that attitude. That's the way we've always done it. So when you have a new person out there, that's a whole fresh vision. And you ought to sit down with them and say, hey, I want you looking around. If you see a better and safer way to do what we're doing, I want to know about it, because you do have a fresh perspective here, and it's going to be gone after a while. You'll someday be that, well, that's the way we've always done it. But right now, while it's fresh and new, I want to see through your eyes. So tell me.
No, I like how you coined that, a new, fresh mission. I love that you went there, because a lot of these new people coming on board, even the fire service, they don't have that experience. Like you said, they've never started a chainsaw. They've never done manual labor, and that's okay. You can't get mad at them. They've just never had those experiences. So if you're able to teach them something or instruct them on something that they're not only going to use in their careers, but in their whole life, why would you be avoiding that? That's a gift.
Yeah, exactly. Make sure you capitalize on everybody. And again, people who are new on a job are going to be intimidated by somebody around them who has 30 years and ranks senior in the organization. You need to take that off the table as a leader. You know, create this environment where it's courageous conversations. So I tell people, you don't want to be surrounded by people that are telling you what they think you want to hear. What you want to say to them is, I don't want to hear what I'm doing right. I want to hear what I'm missing. I want to hear what you think we can do better. That's what I want to hear. Don't sit there and tell me what I'm doing right.
No, it takes a lot of humility to do that as well.
Exactly. Check your ego at the door, folks. If you're in a leadership position, you don't want to be in a position where you're blocking people out, for whatever reason. In hazardous operations, again, there's no place for that. You want to be inspiring people. People ask me, what's the difference between a leader and a manager? And my short definition is that is managers tell people what to do. Leaders inspire them to do it. Mm. And you want to be one of those guys that inspire people to do it.
That's a phenomenal way to keep this conversation going. I'm trying to write that down at the same time. We're coming close to the end here. And one of the questions I always ask in terms of the fire service, I always ask the question, okay, in the fire service, what are some of your concerns that are on your mind these days, things that keep you up at night? So on a broader scale, in terms of leadership in general, or the normalization of deviance, or whatever that comes to your mind from this conversation, are there any things that are concerning to you these days as you look out from the span of your experience and look at where we are today in country or in the emergency response? Does anything concern you?
I don't want to get into politics.
Okay. Probably a good idea.
I see a lot of things I'd like to fix, but keep me awake at night. I just don't want to get into those topics where you're really touching on politics. And then everything we've said to the point where people on one side or the other are going to just tune it out. So people are so oriented in one camp or the other. So what you just asked me, all of my concerns are probably would touch on politics.
No, well, actually, you sort of answered it in terms of like the polarization and maybe again, like another topic for another day, definitely. But I see where you're coming from, and you're right. It's one of those things. When I ask the question, I get a lot of positive responses, which is really pleasing to me. Like, for example, I was asking somebody last time I was on the podcast, and a lot of times people will go, well, I'm concerned with the newer guys coming on, not having the tactical experience or the lack of fires or whatever it is. But a lot of them are more positive these days because they're seeing what this new generation brings on board. And as long as we're doing our part to kind of be, as you just said, the mentors that are encouraging them to converse and showing them what they need to do because they maybe never have the exposure to it. It's more positive. I get more positive responses than negative. And
I guess on that vein, I could certainly say, looking out there in the space business and astronauts, I think just some really terrifically talented people are now in the astronaut business. The engineers that are out there working are young and eager, and I feel really, really, really good about that. I think if I had had magic wand, I would tap everybody in the head and say, let's all work to be better people. Every day, wake up and say, how can I be better? Better parent, a better spouse, a better friend, a better team member, better co-worker, a better leader, you know, how can I be better? And at the end of the day, you know, if I wanted to say what I would like everybody to do is enable, let's build an environment where everybody can bring their best to the table. That's how you have a wonderful team and how, frankly, you have a wonderful country. I think too many people are worried about, you know, how to change other people, where we should be saying, how can I change myself and make it better for people to bring their best to the table? Now, you may have only a small group of people where you can exercise that to bring their best to the table. But if we all did it, just imagine what the country would be, where we would all be doing it. So everybody's best could be brought to the table, not worried about, you know, various things, colors and race and religion and sexual orientation and all that other thing that fragment us. Just, hey, let's make ourselves better so everybody can bring their best to the table.
Love it. And that's a phenomenal way to start closing up this conversation. So, and as we do start closing this up, I just want to, and just so you know, I'm a note taker, so I've been taking a lot of notes through this whole thing. I tend to take a lot of notes. So as I'm reviewing kind of what we just talked about, and again, first of all, the fact that we're able to have this conversation for the listeners, just please keep in mind how we got here. I asked a question. You know, it's amazing what you get if you just ask. I found Mr. Millian's website. I've known about him for a while, and I asked him if he would do this, and he did. And I'm just very grateful for you to have this conversation.
Happy to do it.
But as I'm going through this, I'm looking at a lot. I'm looking at just a ton of information. I'm looking at things like Diane Bond's book on the Challenger and how, you know, that's where you got that from, and you give credit to her. We were talking about the definition of normalization and deviance, and which you refer to, amongst other things, as repeatedly taking shortcuts and developing a new normal and just different things, responding to situations that are pressure or stress. I do like how you definitely dove into, even though there's job-related normalization to deviance, there's situations as you self-impose pressures, as you mentioned. And you went into that a little bit, which I thought was a great conversation. You mentioned predictable surprises and experience-based things that you get away with over a long time become the norm. We talked about how to tackle these things, and we talked about procedural compliance. You mentioned repetition quite frequently, and that repetition, those repetitive tasks, and how those could be dangerous. We talked about how procedures, you need to be procedurally present, that some of these, a lot of them are written in blood, as you said. And we also discussed things like why. In other words, we have these procedures, we have the SOPs, we have these things we're supposed to follow. And over time, people just either don't do them, forget why they're there. But not only by explaining why, having those conversations as you put them, leading by example, are ways to just make sure we keep going on those procedures. You mentioned the word professional, and I think that just, as I'm following up with these notes here, kind of spoke to me the most. We're professionals. You know, we're not just a bunch of, the fire service has come a long way, and we are professionals. This is a profession. So, and I think that we know that going into work, we're not going to work, we're reporting to duty, to entirely different mindsets of way to think. And our duty is to protect the citizens, the business owners, the residents of our, where we go. But we are a profession, and professionally monitoring ourselves, having those crucial conversations, those courageous conversations, encouraging people to come to you. This is just what we should be doing. We are professional. And at the end of it, like you said, building an environment where everybody brings their best forward. I think that sums it all up at the end. And I appreciate this just as I'm wrapping this up, where this went. So as we kind of come to the close, sir, for you, what's on your radar these days?
Well, I've got 6 grandkids, so spent a lot of time traveling to meet. They're all scattered, so they're off doing their. We had children very early in my life, so all my grandkids are I think the youngest is about 20 now, and the oldest about 26 or so. And my kids are thinking about retirement not too many years from now. That'll tell you you're old folks when you're thinking about retirement. But at any rate, I've got a lot of family that I enjoy being around. I love backpacking in the mountains of Colorado and New Mexico. I still do that. I always like to show a slide of me. Last Memorial Day, I climbed Mount Elbert in Colorado. That's the highest peak in Colorado, the second highest peak in the continental U.S. It's up at 14,440 feet. And I was 77 when I climbed it. So I have on my slide of me standing there, I have geezer's rule. Geezer's rule, folks. No, I do like mountain climbing and being involved with the family as much as I can. And I do a lot of speaking still. I still go out and talk safety to a lot of organizations.
Well, like I said, sir, this has been, you know, it's to say this has been a great conversation is an understatement. And once again, I say I thank you for your time here. I know your time is valuable. So as we're closing up here, just as a reminder, we do these conversations and these get posted the second Friday of every month. If you want to know more, obviously, you can look up Mr. Mullane on his website. Is it MikeMullane.com, I believe?
MikeMullane.com, yeah.
And between the books that are out there, between the videos that you just pop his name in, they pop up. They're still relevant today as they were when he first put them out there. And if you're more interested in this conversation, I suggest you take a look at those. So, sir, that being said, any last words?
Well, I was going to say I have a book out there that my life story called Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. And Steve mentioned that at the beginning, but I did want to make a point. It's not a children's book. Okay. There's adult language, adult circumstances, and adult humor that make it, in my opinion, inappropriate for young kids. I, a lot of people hear astronaut, oh, I'm looking for his books. And I'll buy this book and give it to my 11-year-old daughter. And you don't want to do that. You want to read that book before you decide when it's age appropriate for young kids. Now, there's other books on that website that are totally appropriate for kids. And you can look at that. But I always like to make that point about that memoir being adult in content.
Good disclaimer. All right. Well, once again, sir, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for having this discussion with me. I wrote down a bunch of notes. I have some homework to do. And I think that's whenever I do these, I end up leaving with more questions and more things that I need to keep working on. But I like that. I like the challenge. I like the continuing of the research that I need to do to keep myself abreast of these things. So thank you so much, sir, for joining me today. It's been a privilege and an honor.
Thank you. Everybody, all my best. Stay safe.
So that being said, thank you to the Fire Engineering, the Clarion team, Diane, David Rhodes. Thanks for everything. Second Friday of every month. We hope you have a wonderful day. Be safe, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of the fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station, leading to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems, only MagnaGrip eliminates 100% of all cancer-causing toxins within the station. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
In the world of firefighting and public safety, reliability is key. That's why for over two decades, first responders nationwide have trusted the Fire Store as their go-to source for essential equipment, apparel, and accessories. From top-of-the-line firefighting gear like helmets, boots, and thermal imaging cameras, the Fire Store has it all, tailored to the specific needs of our heroes on the front lines. But they don't stop there. Their extensive selection also includes EMS supplies, safety apparel like flame-resistant clothing and high-visibility gear, as well as a wide array of tools from hand tools to vehicle extrication tools, supporting public safety professionals in their duties. Partnered with industry leaders, the Fire Store's commitment to quality and excellence is unmatched, because when it comes to protecting communities, there's no room for compromise. Join the thousands of first responders who rely on the Fire Store. Visit thefirestore.com online or in-store today. The Fire Store, your reliable partner for fire and public safety equipment.